Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, my friends, and welcome to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host, Eric Peabody, and tonight we're going to be reading two stories, both dealing with forces outside of our natural world. To open, we'll be covering The Eye of the Storm by John Westrick. This story is about a young man and his grandfather in Florida doing their best to tough out a hurricane. As the eye of the storm approaches, both are expecting a respite from the chaos raging outside. But as luck has it, they couldn't be further from the truth. Then, to close out tonight's episode, we'll read Familiar Acceptance by Shane H. Sellers. Tom and Jason are two researchers on a secret government project, and they've just been called in very early on a weekend. Upon arriving, they learn that some unknown entity has breached the facility. This creature has certain abilities that make it very hard to detect, and several people are already dead. With the clock ticking, it's a race against time to stop the creature before it reaches the wider world. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author John Westrick, I give you The Eye of the Storm. The storm slithered across the countryside, consuming all in its path. Hurricanes are nasty, especially in southern Florida. This one was a Category 4, with sustained winds of 150 miles per hour. Most people evacuate in such a storm, but not my grandpa. The man is as stubborn as a boulder, with less emotion to boot. He's hard, difficult to love, but not entirely without his charm. He is faithful, slow, and steady, and always does what he says. Grandpa's cut from a different cloth, old school through and through. His face is as severe as the storm, and his demeanor equally so. No one would consider him a pleasant man, not even his wife. For this reason, he lives alone in Hendry County on a plantation. I found myself stuck in the crosshairs of this ungodly devastation for his sake. I was worried for him. I'm his eldest grandchild, so I felt responsible to care for him. To this day, I regret my decision. It left me scarred. Sleep eludes me. I lay in my bed, unable to keep my eyes closed. In the stillness of the early morning, I hear his desperate cries. I told myself there was nothing I could do. This is probably true, but fear stole my breath away. I was powerless to stop them. Storms are the worst. The panic attacks begin. The memories come back in a flood of emotions. I remember all the details. I hear the screams, the noises no human mouth could produce. My therapist says they're fantasies my mind conjured to distract me from my loss. I want nothing more than to believe this, yet I know it's not so. I saw the eye. The crotchety old bastard shouted, "Jeb, move your ass! The storm's approaching. We still need to gather all the cattle into the barn." Thoroughly regretting my decision to help the old man, I responded, "I'm going as fast as I can. Yelling at me isn't going to make it better." At this point, the wind was whipping through the trees. The rain was pelting us in the face, feeling like pinpricks on our exposed skin. This was so stupid. The old man had insurance on the farm, and all damages would be recompensed. Love makes you do dumb things. The old man was the only family I had left. My mom died in childbirth, and my dad drank himself to death. Suicide, one sip at a time. Death by the bottle. I was left alone, with no family members who cared for me. No legal guardian at the age of 14. Confused, lost, bouncing from couch to couch. Consumed by anger at my mother for abandoning me, disgust for the weakness of my father, and jealousy of my friends who had loved ones. This is how Terrence Terry Clearwater found me. He took me in without a second thought. His level-headedness grounded me. The old man was the only consistent thing in my life. He genuinely saved me. Guilt and shame shatter my heart when I remember this. A debt to my grandpa will forever be unpaid. When he needed me most, I froze. The storm roared. It surprised me how loud hurricanes could be. A war was being fought outside, an onslaught of winds and rain against the longevity of the trees and stones. Judging from the noise, it seemed as if the storm was winning. We made our way indoors, stacking the heaviest beds and dressers against the windows. We weren't keen on having a branch tossed through the window to impale anyone. I began to fill the bathtubs and sinks with water, knowing that at any time the power could go out. After we felt confident enough in our fortifications, the two of us gathered in the living room to distract ourselves from the tempest huffing and puffing and trying to blow our house down. I dealt out cards. I was in the second game of poker when the lights began to flicker. Before we could even finish our hand, the lights were out altogether. For a second, we sat in the dark, listening to the wind and rain. It was oddly peaceful. And that was the last peaceful moment I had with my grandpa. Sometimes I wake up to tears staining my pillowcase, yearning for that moment again. I don't think I would light the candles. I would just let the moment linger, stretching it out for as long as possible. I miss his gruff voice and rough hands, the sturdy pat on my shoulder, his signature way of showing me that he cared for me. He never outright said he loved me, but it was clear by his actions. Words are cheap, but actions are invaluable. He was invaluable to me. I ignited the flashlight and lit a sufficient number of candles. My nose was assaulted by warring scents. Each tried to compete with its counterpart. The room smelled of pomegranates and maple, cinnamon and ocean breeze. Any smell imaginable was present. The smells made me queasy. At least, that's what I thought then. Looking back at it now, I'm convinced somewhere in my subconscious, I was aware of what was about to happen. My grandpa grabbed his portable battery-operated radio, the one he used to listen to ball games, and switched it to the local weather channel. In a crackling, staticky tone, the weather host predicted that the eye of the storm should be passing Hendry County in the next few minutes. The charming woman's voice promised that the worst had passed and there shouldn't be much more to worry about. She advised us to stay hunkered down and wait the remainder of the storm out. The woman could not have been more wrong. The storm, in one final torrent of ungodly fury, blew with all its combined strength. An awful ripping noise, a crack, and an explosion. The 100-year-old oak in our front yard smashed through the kitchen window. I remember staring up through the gaping hole in the ceiling, seeing the pitch black of night, darkened by the suffocating clouds and whipping winds. I felt as if I was staring into the depths of the abyss itself. The storm at that moment ceased. No more wind, no rain. The clouds parted so that the moon was visible. It was full, the eye of God peering down on us. I stared perplexed at the moon. It was the color of blood congealed on a corpse. The visage was malevolent by nature. It was not the celestial body I was used to. It was foreign, uncomfortably large. The moon seemed to open wide and swallow the night sky. This false moon had one dark spot in the center, a pupil in the center of an eye. The longer I looked at it, the more it peeked into the depths of my soul. It was alive. More than that, it meant harm. I was certain of this. I can't tell you how I knew it, but there was no doubt. The night sky, other than the crimson glow radiating from that celestial eye, was darker. It wasn't merely darkness. It was inky blackness, void of any light. It was the sky bathed in pitch. No light refracted. No light illuminated. My flashlight's beam seemed to be choked in the night, an anorexic illumination emitting from the spotlight. Where my LED light should have ignited the sky like an offspring of the sun itself, it barely allowed me to see the far wall of the room. It was as if the cruelty of the storm split the fabric of our reality, only to have the hole filled by this monstrosity. Perhaps that's exactly what occurred. I'm not sure. I can't explain what I saw. I just know that my grandpa was there, and then after the storm, he wasn't. Regardless, I found my adolescent self staring at the night. I can't rightly tell you how long me and my grandpa stood, looking at the eye in the sky. We didn't speak. What was there to say? We were glued to our spot, necks contorted, eyes locked on the celestial body. I'm not even sure I blinked once the entire time. My eyes refused to break the soul gaze for one moment. Soul gaze it was. I understood vileness at that moment. I met true darkness. Fear did more than fill my heart. It consumed me, a shadowy beast tearing into my sanity. I felt myself wandering, my consciousness being lost forever. It was the blood-curdling cries and that inky blackness that broke my mind's wandering. It was off in the distance, but I could not locate the origins. The darkness did more than distort light. The sound was odd. It was as if the night had substance to it, causing the sound waves to bounce off of it. Echolocation was impossible. One moment, the sound would come from behind me. The next, it would be just outside of my field of vision. I couldn't tell if the creatures were leagues away or if they lurked right outside of sight. A different type of fear seized me. This kind was animalistic and natural, whereas the previous type was philosophical and soul-wrenching. There was a predator on the loose, my mind could comprehend. Before, that eye in the sky induced a fear that ripped at my understanding entirely. It was something superseding my insignificant intellect. Still, my body became erect. My senses fired on all cylinders, attempting to detect and protect. The carnal portion of my mind took over. Self-preservation kicked in, and I unconsciously shuffled towards my grandpa. My instincts remembered how it was like in those earlier days, those days when we weren't the top of the food chain. Humans are herd creatures by nature. We build sprawling metropolises so we don't have to remember those days when creatures stalked us in the night. We try so hard to banish the darkness with our artificial light, yet still we wake screaming in the middle of the night from those phantom memories from our ancestors. Those memories of monsters and creatures so evil we try to forget. We haven't forgotten, and neither have they. We huddled there, me and my grandfather, under the dinner table, unwilling to make a sound, hoping, praying that the howls would fall off in the distance. No such thing happened. Fear muddled our minds, and we could hardly even breathe. Eventually, my grandfather whispered in a voice barely audible, "We need to get to the attic. We're exposed here. We'd stand a better chance of hiding. Also, my guns are in the lockbox there." Mostly because I lacked a better plan myself, and I was petrified to be alone, I followed him as we crept from under the table to the corner of the room. On all fours, we crawled from one side of the room to the other, careful to not make a sound. The cries were getting desperate. Hollering, slobbering noises produced in the back of the throat. They made my blood run cold. In the dim light of my flashlight, I saw my grandfather trembling. His hands shook and his face grew sweaty. The bestial calls were terrifying, but I'd never seen my grandpa scared. This absolutely paralyzed me with fear. My grandpa survived the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and helped train people in Desert Storm. If he was worried, then I knew we were in dire straits. We weren't moving fast enough. I was deadly afraid that those creatures stalking us would catch up to us. As we barreled forward, scuttling as fast as we dared, we turned the hall to run face to face with one of those creatures. It resembled a dog. I mean this in the loosest way possible. It was made of shadow. I don't mean it was shadowy. I mean the body was formed by the swirling darkness. Its paws were too large for the sleek frame, extended even longer by cruel claws protruding from its tips. The beast had twisted spines piercing its bent back. Its skin was flaky, like it was afflicted with a serious case of mange. Thank God I was unable to see the creature's face. Its ears were notched and stood erect. They shortened and lengthened in a mesmerizing pattern that was oddly pleasing to the eye. We backed away slowly, making sure we didn't lose sight of the demon dog. In reverse, we made our way to the living room, hoping to make it to the staircase. As we scooted along, we heard a scratching sound coming from the kitchen. My head twisted with breakneck speed to get a glimpse of a second creature climbing through the hole created by the fallen tree. We were exposed to it. The creature only had to look up from its incessant scratching to see us. Forgetting all pretenses, we climbed to our feet, scrambling across the hardwood hallway for the living room. I wasn't even trying to hide my footfalls. I fled with all my might. My grandpa was right behind me. The creatures heard our ragged breathing and our heavy footfalls, and in seconds, they were in hot pursuit. Snarls and slobbering yowls echoed down the hallway after us. Panic seized me, and I ran faster than I ever thought possible. When I made it to the stairway, I turned to look back. My grandpa was a few strides behind me. The creatures were barreling towards him. He wasn't going to make it. Our eyes locked, and I saw that he saw he wasn't going to make it. His lips formed, "I love you, son." It was the first time I had ever heard him say it. Tears filled my eyes. I knew I ought to help him, yet my feet remained locked firmly to the spot. I watched as he changed course and began to run towards the front door. The creatures were drawn further away from me. Still, I was unable to move. I stood there, stunned, struck dumb in the presence of my grandpa's final heroic act. Time was put on rewind, and for a second, I saw the man my bent grandfather used to be. A glorious man, young and full of life. He stood tall, accepting his death with stoic grace. My grandpa turned to me and we locked eyes. A moment passed, and then he bellowed, "Go! Get out of here! Grab the gun and hide!" As if it was magic, the ice in my veins melted. I moved with the grace of an Olympic athlete. I flung myself up the stairs 3 steps at a time. I barreled through the spare bedroom, slamming the closet door against the plaster wall. I pulled the drawstring for the attic door up above my head. I shot up the pull-down ladder and found myself in pitch darkness. If I could only get to my grandpa's shotgun, maybe I could help him. I cursed my squeamish nature that caused my grandpa to place the guns up there in the first place. It couldn't be too late. I couldn't lose him, too. He was all that I had left. As if to make a liar of me, immediately I heard a familiar voice echoing from downstairs. It was my grandpa, screaming. Tears filled my eyes, and my vision began to sway. Those screams. Those god-awful pleas for help. They tore great swaths out of my still-beating heart. I was consumed by those creatures, if not bodily, then emotionally. My grandpa. My strong, stubborn, and independent grandpa. I was left alone again, in the dark, with no one to guide me. I collapsed to my knees in that scorching attic. I looked to the heavens, hoping to see God. All I saw, through a leaking crack in the roof, was that damned eye. The blood moon seemed to wink at me, pleased with the activities of this night. I heard the unearthly screeches of those dogs taper off. It was just me and the celestial body. We stared at each other for a moment, then two. The eye in the sky didn't want flesh. It wanted this. It wanted to gorge itself on my pain, the kind that remains, the kind no doctor can heal with clever medicines. The insatiable pain of loss, with no hope of recovery. A broken heart unable to be mended. Guilt for actions not taken, and prices not paid. I used to think I was brave, a strong man. Now I know the truth. Me and that eye both saw. I am a coward, through and through. Willing to let those I love pay the price, while I stay cowering in safety. That night, I protected my own worthless skin, but I lost my soul in the doing. With one final glance, I looked and saw that eye, and it saw me. I knew it, and it knew me. Then the winds picked up, and the clouds obscured that eye from my sight. I would like to say I've never seen it since, but every time I close my eyes, I still see it. You see, I live my life under the watchful gaze of that celestial eye.
ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You've been listening to The Eye of the Storm by John Westrick. And now, from Shane H. Sellers, I present Familiar Acceptance. It was an early Saturday morning when Jason pulled up in front of my house. Grabbing my briefcase and ID card from the kitchen counter, I walked to the front door, careful not to wake Janice and the kids, who were still tucked snugly in their beds. Outside, the neighborhood was dark and silent, the streetlights still bright. Walking across the porch, the cool spring morning nipped at my arms, causing me to rub my hands together for warmth. I descended the front steps, taking a moment to admire my manicured front yard before entering the Cadillac. Inside, the interior smelled of fresh leather and strong coffee as Jason turned to greet me.
"Morning, Tom. Hope you slept well."
"It would have been better if I were still sleeping," I said, buckling my seatbelt. Jason chuckled, shaking his head as he put the Cadillac in drive and started down the quiet neighborhood street.
"So what's the deal with the all hands on a Saturday?" I said, looking out the window as the car turned onto the main road towards the base.
"The colonel sent an order out last night. Seems like the R&D boys done fucked something up."
"Fucking R&D. I hope this isn't as bad as that autonomous recon trooper fiasco last year," I groaned.
The previous year, R&D had airdropped a fully armed recon droid for testing. The only problem was it blew off course, landing in a public park. Before we found it, the droid had used its 30mm chain gun to blast two teenage dropouts.
"You know, the cleanup on that job still makes me want to take a shower," I said.
Jason nodded in agreement, his eyes concentrated on the road as Casey Kasem announced the next top 40 on the radio. Together, Jason and I had worked at the base for 7 years, gaining each other's respect and trust as fellow scientific field agents. Despite Jason being 52 and sporting at least 280 pounds, he performed well. Generally, field work is for the young pups like me, but the brass wanted someone with seasoned experience. The best they could do was a guy that resembled a mall Santa Claus and enjoyed playing Dungeons & Dragons. We approached the main gate, where two military policemen stopped us. The first, a young private, checked our ID cards, while an older sergeant used a telephone to confirm our entry to the base. After a few minutes, the older sergeant entered his duty shack, lowering the tire spike barriers and raising the gate for our entry. From there, we drove past several barracks until reaching another guard gate for the base lab.
"We're here,"
Jason said, parking the car close to the entrance. I grabbed my briefcase from the floorboard and exited the Cadillac. The sun was just starting to crest over the horizon as I surveyed the semi-empty parking lot.
"Were we the only ones to get the invitation?"
I asked, looking at Jason as he struggled to put on his white lab coat.
"Not sure. Could be a need-to-know thing. You drive on the way back," he replied, tossing me the keys to the Cadillac.
I put the keys into my pocket and began walking toward the front entrance, where I scanned my access card to unlock the door. The lobby inside was sparsely decorated with large potted plants that added a soft touch to the sterile white floor. Towards the back, a guard sat behind a large cherry wood desk that flanked a stainless steel elevator. I took one last look at the outside parking lot as Jason entered behind me before walking to the front desk.
"Good morning, gentlemen,"
the young guard said as he met us. Jason and I relinquished our ID cards to the guard, a practice that was almost automatic after years of working at the lab. The guard pulled out a clipboard, silently inspecting it, before placing a phone call to the lower floor.
"This is the front desk. I have Mr. Timothy Frazier and Mr. Jason Buller waiting for an escort,"
the young guard said into the phone.
The guard listened intently and then hung up the phone, escorting us to the elevator. An electronic ding emitted from the control box as the up arrow flashed green. Jason rocked back on his heels, whistling, while the guard resumed his front desk duty. I pretended to look at my watch, trying to avoid small talk, when the elevator door opened, revealing Harker. Harker was a big man with short brown hair and a mustache that would make Tom Selleck jealous. As usual, he wore business attire, but had ditched the coat in favor of a white button-up shirt with the sleeves rolled up. On his shoulder, a brown leather strap hung low with an Uzi submachine gun attached.
"Gee, Harker, what's with the hardware?" Jason said, pointing toward the gun.
Harker grinned before motioning us onto the elevator.
"Gotta escort you boys safely to the boss man."
As I entered the elevator, I couldn't help but feel uneasy at the comment. Why would we need an armed escort down in the lab? Sure, security was tight, but I'd never seen Harker armed like this. My thoughts were interrupted as the elevator door shut and began its descent.
"Did you gentlemen catch the Redskins game last night?"
Harker asked, leaning against the elevator wall.
"Can't say I did," I responded, looking back at Harker and then to Jason. "I haven't watched a ball game in 10 years, Jason said with a look of admiration.
"Really? Why?" Harker asked, genuinely perplexed by Jason's response.
"Sunday is my campaign day. Currently, I'm playing the Keep on the Borderlands."
Jason smiled. This answer seemed to confuse Harker even more. The elevator bounced to a stop, the door opening to reveal the main lab hallway. On each side, doors branched off to various wings of the facility, illuminated by the hum of bright fluorescent lights.
"All right, gentlemen, I got orders to escort you to the break room and then to the head. You are not to leave my sight at any time. We got 15 minutes before meeting with the colonel, so do your business now," Harker said, stepping out of the elevator. "I'd like to visit the restroom first," Jason said, raising his hand like a student would in the classroom.
Harker let out an audible sigh.
"All right, let's reverse the order of the agenda. Follow me."
We walked along, our steps squeaking on the shiny tile floor, before coming to a stop at the nearest bathroom. Harker motioned for us to stand against the wall as he opened all three of the bathroom stalls before walking back and sitting on the counter.
"All right, gentlemen, it's safe."
I took a step forward to the urinal while Jason walked toward the nearest stall. Harker rushed over to the stall that Jason entered, his hand firmly gripping the door before Jason could close it.
"Sorry, champ, gotta have eyes on you," Harker said. "Seriously? You're gonna sit there and watch me take a dump?"
Jason replied in disbelief.
"Orders are orders, champ. Just close your eyes and pretend you're at the beach or something." "Since when have I taken a shit on the beach?" Jason retorted. "Hey, you use that nerd imagination of yours to teleport wherever you want, but the door stays open," Harker said with a look of authority.
What the hell was going on here? I thought as I finished relieving myself. Whatever it wasn't good, and the faster we found out, the sooner we could leave this subterranean shithole. Jason gave up on his morning poop by flushing the toilet with a look of frustration.
"Don't worry, champ, there'll be more bathroom breaks in the future," Harker said with a relaxed smile.
After washing our hands, we elected to bypass the break room, instead choosing to head to the colonel's office. Harker knocked on a wooden door that proudly displayed a brass-polished plaque with Colonel William Weston on it. A few seconds ticked by until the door was opened by a large black man dressed like Harker.
"You verify these two haven't left your side?"
the man said, pointing his Uzi at Harker.
"Been with him the whole time, even watched Willy Wonka over there try to make fudge."
Jason turned a shade of red at the remark as Harker looked down at the barrel of the submachine gun and then back up to the guard.
"All clear, sir,"
the man said, lowering the gun and opening the door to the office. Silently, we filed into the room as Harker pointed to two leather chairs for us to sit in. Behind a large oak desk sat the colonel, a balding white man in his 60s. His uniform was adorned with various campaign ribbons and badges, indicating his years of military service.
"Good morning, gentlemen. I see Harker has safely escorted you inside. This is Chambers. He's a security professional like Harker," the colonel said, rifling through a red folder with the words "Top Secret" stamped across the front. Jason and I looked at each other as the colonel pulled two pages out and neatly arranged them on his desk before speaking.
"Last night, Dr. Kenji and three others in research and development were working on Project Companion when a security breach was detected. Surveillance cameras picked up two anomalies at 2200 and 2210. These anomalies were thought to be electronic interference caused by the radioactive isotope the team was using during the test. Our video forensics was able to pull still frames from the footage. Gentlemen, what you're about to see is strictly classified." Chambers walked over, taking two photos from the colonel's hand and placing them in front of us. I reached into my briefcase, retrieving my glasses, while Jason took the first photo. Once I had my glasses, I held the photo up to the bright fluorescent light, carefully inspecting the details. The photo showed five men dressed in surgical gowns surrounding a mummified corpse that lay curled on a stainless steel table. Everything seemed normal. The men were hunched over with various instruments in hand. But something was off with the man on the far right. His features were longer or more exaggerated than the rest. "I thought you said it was Dr. Kenji and three others," I asked, still focusing on the strange man dressed in surgical garb.
"That's correct, Mr. Frazier. There were only four individuals in that lab, but at 2200, a fifth individual appeared and for 10 minutes worked alongside Dr. Kenji and his staff without notice. Then, at 2210, everything changed," the colonel said, motioning to Jason to pass the other photo to me. The second photo revealed a room stacked shoulder to shoulder with misshaped men. Some of them had extra limbs, while others seemed to hang from the ceilings and walls. The fifth man from the first photo glared up at the camera, his mouth full of what appeared to be fingers instead of teeth. A trace of fear gnawed at the back of my spine as the room instantly felt cold.
"Dr. Kenji and his staff were terminated by the lab's emergency incinerators," the colonel said, leaning back into his leather chair.
"You mean they're all dead?" Jason questioned.
"So if the lab incinerators destroyed everything, then why are we here?" I said, looking back to the photo. Chambers stepped forward, taking the photos before speaking.
"Security sensors detected motion outside the lab right after the incident. As per protocol, we locked down the east wing and pumped in decontamination foam. That's when we lost contact with the control room."
"How many were in the control room?" Jason asked.
"Three. Saunders, Fisk, and Nelson."
"Where are they now?" I asked. Chambers went to answer, but the colonel held up a hand before responding.
"Gentlemen, anyone who was in the East Wing should be considered no longer with us. Which leads me to why you're both here. I need a solution to stop this before it spreads any further."
"I recommend a mixture of hydrofluoric acid," the man standing in the far corner said. I hadn't seen him when we first entered the colonel's office, yet I felt he had always been there. I looked to Jason, who had the same puzzled look, before turning back to the colonel. The colonel shifted in his seat with a perplexed look.
"I'm sorry, gentlemen, this is...
I'm a doctor," the man said as he crossed two of his arms and rested another pair on his hips.
"Yes, doctor. Apologies, I forgot you were there," the colonel replied.
"Hydrofluoric acid is oddly specific for this task. Why do you propose we use that?" Jason asked.
The doctor's right eye seemed to droop down to his cheek as he walked to the chalkboard behind us. Both Jason and I turned to face him as he began to draw on the board.
"Think of the anomaly like a fun house of mirrors that distort your image. The first mirror you see reflects yourself. The same reflection is then cast to other mirrors that surround you, and those images are cast to even more mirrors. Your image is still familiar, but now vastly different as the reflection moves further away."
The doctor drew on the board to articulate his lesson. The drawings were a mix of scribbles and scratches that resembled what a 2-year-old might do given the same piece of chalk. We can't smash the mirrors. That would only make more shards, more reflections. What we need to do is dissolve the mirrors, thus hydrofluoric acid, the doctor said with a smile that stretched past his ears. Suddenly, the doctor's chest exploded as the room filled with the crack of automatic gunfire. I dropped to the floor as a burst of hot lead exploded the doctor's head into a red mist of teeth, hair, and bone. The body swayed back and forth, falling to the floor only inches from me. Hot bile mixed with this morning's oatmeal spewed forth as I vomited. My ears and head pounded from the concussion of the gunfire.
"Jesus Christ, you shot the doctor!"
the colonel shouted, peering behind his desk. "Sir, he's not human," Harker said, pointing the smoking barrel of the gun at the lump of flesh. Jason crawled back away from the body.
"I shit myself!" he cried.
I leaned against the chair, looking at the remains. The clothes were nothing more than skin imitating the pattern and color of the clothing we wore. How did I not see the extra pair of arms or the multitude of fingers on his hand? I stood up, wiping the oatmeal from my mouth and lending a hand to Jason.
"Good thing we got it," said a woman next to Chambers.
I rubbed the bridge of my nose with my thumb and index finger, pointing towards the woman.
"She's not real."
The woman stepped back, squeezing her 3 breasts together.
"Honey, I'm all real woman."
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Chambers unloaded his Uzi, causing Jason to fall back on his ass with a grimace of disgust. The woman's body seemed to dance with the gunfire until it slammed into the wall and slid to the floor, leaving a bloody skid mark. Chambers ejected the empty magazine, inserting a fresh one into the gun and cocking the bolt back. White, billowing clouds of spent gunpowder hung heavy in the air, stinging my eyes.
"What the fuck?"
Jason yelled as he crawled back to his feet. The colonel climbed from behind his desk, inspecting the woman's body, while Harker moved to the office door.
"Your orders, sir?"
The colonel seemed to linger before going to a red phone on his desk.
"We need to do a full incineration of the site."
"What the fuck?"
Harker exclaimed.
"That'll roast us,"
Jason protested. I leapt forward, putting my hand over the receiver before interjecting.
"I have a better idea. We get chemical suits from the supply room and flush the site with hydrofluoric acid." "You want us to take an acid bath?"
Jason interjected.
"The suits are acid resistant, and we can wash ourselves off with the locker showers once the acid's been dispensed. Anything not wearing a suit is going to be a big steamy pile of gore once we're done."
"You're going to listen to that thing's advice?"
Chambers said with a look of confusion.
"I think the anomaly is an extension of our own selves. Or at least it thinks it is. It creates its own persona based on what it's interacted with. So if Dr. Kenji had suggested the acid prior to the lab being incinerated, then the anomaly might use that same dialogue as camouflage. I'd also wager there's a canister of the stuff down by the lab pump station just for this scenario," I said, holding my hand up to calm the situation.
"That doesn't make sense, Tom. Why would it tell us how to destroy it? Why didn't we recognize it?"
Jason questioned.
"It didn't know. It's just imitating. Monkey see, monkey do.
The fact we didn't notice it at first is something I can't explain. Maybe it's the power of suggestion. Like hypnosis." The colonel looked at the red phone and then back to me.
"You sure this'll work?"
he said, stepping back from the phone. "I'm not sure of anything, sir, but it's either this or we burn." We stood looking at one another as silent thoughts raced across our faces.
The colonel slowly nodded his head, approving the plan, as Harker opened the office door, stepping out into the foyer. Chambers followed behind, motioning for us to follow. We traveled down the vestibule past the break room, the facility quiet except for the sounds of our footsteps echoing off the floor. Up ahead, I could make out a large double door with the sign Supply posted in the middle. Harker jogged towards the entrance, coming to an abrupt stop and turning to scan behind us. Jason was being pushed by Chambers as he struggled to keep up, when the lights of the facility dimmed and flickered off. We all paused, breathing heavily in the dark confines of the hallway. Jason held out a small pen light, illuminating the group.
"Emergency lighting should be on any second," the colonel said, moving beside me.
We proceeded to enter the supply room, where a large counter faced the door with bins full of various items lining the wall behind it. To our right, a pair of swing doors led to a room with rows of large metal shelves. A gurney sat pressed against the wall with a shopping cart.
"First things first, we need suits and flashlights with batteries," the colonel said, pointing to the barely visible shelves.
"I recommend the flashlights first. Seems like the emergency lighting isn't kicking in," Chambers whispered.
"This looks to be the inventory list,"
Jason said as he grabbed the clipboard hanging on the wall. For a moment, we were cast in darkness as Jason redirected the tiny beam of light onto the clipboard. His finger traced the list as he flipped the first page over and came to a stop halfway down the second page.
"Flashlights and batteries are on aisle 2. Chemical suits are on 4.
Jason pointed the tiny beam towards the shelves, pushing the shopping cart towards aisle 2. About 10 steps down, he stopped, retrieving several flashlights and D-cell batteries from the shelves. The group took no time in putting these to use, illuminating the supply room with wide angles of light. Jason pushed the cart, rounding the corner and turning toward the last row of shelves against the far wall.
"There."
I pointed to a stack of individually wrapped chemical suits and respirators on the third shelf. Jason stopped in mid-stride, turning away from the group and walking to the nearest aisle.
"What the fuck are you doing?" Harker hissed.
Jason ignored him, undoing his belt and removing his dress slacks.
"We don't have time for this,"
Chambers barked. Jason kicked his shoes off, shaking his head in frustration, before turning to Harker and then to Chambers.
"Any of you shit yourselves, huh? Seriously, I've been walking up and down this facility with mud in my trunks."
Chambers paused with a look of bewilderment as Jason was handed a pair of clean overalls from a conjoined twin sitting on the shelves. The first head smiled, revealing a set of enlarged molars that resembled a horse. The other head, a face full of eyes, blinked in unison as it turned away from the beam of the flashlight.
Jason,
I stammered.
"No, Tom, I'm fucking done with this place. I don't give a shit anymore. These jackasses can go fuck themselves,"
Jason yelled as he put one foot into the overalls. Harker pushed me out of the way as he and Chambers lifted their Uzis towards Jason. Jason's eyes went wide as he stared down the barrels of both guns.
"Is there one behind me?"
he whimpered. I nodded slowly as the conjoined twin climbed down from the shelf behind Jason.
"Fuck me!"
Jason yelled, diving to the floor just as Harker and Chambers opened fire. Hot brass kicked high in the air as the round snapped into the deformed twin's body, causing a wet explosion of viscera. The colonel ducked down, sticking his fingers in his ears as the roar of gunfire echoed through the concrete room. Jason started crawling on all fours across the floor just as Chambers fired his last shot. The twin staggered back, reeling from its wounds as Harker and Chambers looked at each other with surprise. The two backed up, trying to distance themselves from the creature as it leaned itself against the heavy steel shelves.
"Last mag!"
Harker exclaimed as he pulled a magazine, handing it to Chambers. Chambers was already leveling his submachine gun towards the twin when it darted forward, seizing the colonel by his shoulders, where he remained crouched with fingers in ears. The creature lifted the colonel high into the air, slamming him face first into the ground with a gut-wrenching crunch of shattered teeth and bones. The twin snorted in defiance before smashing the colonel's head flat with its large foot. A loud pop emitted as the skull broke open and brain matter squirted like strawberry jelly across the floor. Chambers opened fire, aiming at the two heads of the anomaly, the bullets turning the twins' faces into a bloody pulp. The anomaly swayed before crashing into the aisle, bringing several of the shelves down on top of it. As the smoke cleared, Chambers held his right hand up in a salute to the colonel's mangled body. The entire spectacle made me feel squeamish, and I could distinctly hear my heart pounding despite the ringing in my ears. I steadied myself by grabbing the nearest shelf, trying to look away from the grisly scene. Jason made his way to the fourth aisle and was already dumping chemical suits into the grocery cart with a manic fervor. I could see terror visibly etched into his face.
"All right, listen up. I'm quarterbacking this shit show now," Harker said.
Chambers seemed to size up Harker, contemplating the changing of leadership.
"Why should I follow you?" he asked.
A smile formed across Harker's face as he held up a plastic key card.
"Cause I got the keys to the armory, bitch, and if you're good, we'll stop for milkshakes on the way."
Chambers smiled back, giving a nod of approval. It took a moment to collect myself, and even longer to console Jason. The day's traumatic events were stacking up. All the while, Harker and Chambers grew increasingly impatient. I'm sure they would have left us had they known how to work the pump station. This knowledge, coupled with the fact that I had provided a solid plan early, gave us some currency. The group made a detour to the armory, where Harker and Chambers swapped their Uzis out for M16 rifles and olive drab bandoliers full of magazines. The pair were in their element, enjoying the thrill of the circumstances as we weaved through the dark corridors of the underground laboratory, arriving at the pump station. Inside, industrial piping spiderwebbed along the walls and ceiling. In the center, three massive pumps sat alongside two steel canisters of compressed hydrofluoric acid. My guess about Dr. Kenji taking precautions was correct.
"Okay, I need to hook the valve up to the main pump. Once the compressed gas is transferred, it should liquefy through the sprinkler systems. It'll take at least 5 minutes for the pump to prime and start dispersing. Once I make the connection, we gotta move to the locker rooms and get under those showers. It's no guarantee, but if we use the extra suits as shields and stay under the water, we should be okay," I said, tearing the bag open on one of the chemical suits.
"That is, if the fumes don't kill us first," Jason chimed in.
The group followed my example, donning the suits and respirators, while I reviewed the coupling instructions for the acid. I started to install the nickel-plated valve into the canister when a loud scream came from outside. Harker picked up his rifle, motioning for Chambers to join him.
"Finish the hookup and meet us outside," he said, opening the steel door.
I looked at Jason, who was focused deeply on the pump. Reaching out, I placed my right hand on his shoulder. "We're gonna get through this." Jason stared at me, eyes full of dread.
"I hope so."
We spent the next moments in silence, connecting the canisters to the pump. When finally finished, I gave a thumbs up to Jason and then opened the main valve and pressure switch. A loud swoosh sound discharged from the canisters as the compressed acid transferred to the pump holding tank. Jason flipped a series of switches at a control terminal, engaging the emergency generator. The pump motor roared to life as gauges and valves started to build pressure. With one final look at Jason, I hit the prime button and released the intake valve for the main sprinkler system. The clock had just started. Wasting no time, we exited the pump station. Harker and Chambers were at the end of the hall with rifles at the ready.
"We gotta move, now," I said, the respirator muffling my voice.
Chambers lifted his rifle towards us, stopping us in our tracks.
"Take the masks off. I need to see if you're human."
"We don't have time for this bullshit," I shouted.
Chambers responded with a hard poke from the barrel of his M16 into my chest. The pain from the strike was immediate, causing me to double over.
"I see faces, or I start blasting," Chambers said.
"Better do what he says, boys," Parker chimed in. Jason was removing the hood of his chemical suit when a nude black man walked next to him and grabbed it. Chambers paused, lowering the rifle as if recognizing the man. Still clutching my chest, I turned to face the stranger, a sense of familiarity accompanying him.
"You guys got a suit for me?"
the man questioned, dropping Jason's hood.
"Why are you running around here naked?"
Chambers asked, oblivious to the man's long fingers that touched the floor.
"Shoot him, Chambers! It's not real!"
Harker yelled. Down the hallway, more voices called out,
"You got a suit for me?"
causing Harker to turn to face a mass of figures walking towards us out of the darkness.
"Fuck!"
Harker bellowed, firing at the incoming crowd. The report of the rifle seemed to refocus Chambers as he stepped back, emptying his rifle into the bald man. Flesh splattered across the wall as the rounds cut through the anomaly with deadly accuracy. I dove to the floor just as Harker pulled the pin on a grenade and threw it at the crowd. A woman, with long spines protruding from her skull, caught the grenade in midair, tossing it back at Harper. The grenade exploded in a deafening fireball of shrapnel, hurling Harker a good 6 feet down the hall. The first few droplets of acid began raining down from the sprinkler. Any second, the full contents of the pump station would expel, flooding the facility in a highly corrosive bath. Jason bumped into me, his face bright red from chemical burns, the exposed skin blistering from the initial drops. Desperately, he tried to cover his face using his gloves, but the acid continued to fall. I reached for my friend as he fought to escape the overbearing pain of the acid. Chambers redirected his rifle towards the group that Harker was fending off. A man with 8 legs scurried across the ceiling towards us like a grotesque spider. Jason, now screaming, his face and beard frothing off like wet tissue paper. Pink foam bubbled from his nose and mouth as he collapsed into my arms. I reached to pick him up, recoiling in horror as my gloved hand came away with gobs of sticky flesh.
"Airborne, motherfucker!"
Chambers yelled, cutting the spider in two with a burst from his rifle. I let go of Jason and ran, my legs driving harder and faster with each step. 3 deformed men tackled Chambers. The 4 struggled, Chambers managing to shoot one in the chest just before another sunk a fire axe into his shoulder, the fight disappearing in the darkness and torrents of acid now coming down full force. I could barely see through the fumes, the acid interacting with the environment around me. Floor tiles cracked while paint peeled from the walls and plastic fittings began to melt. Bursting through the locker room doors, I ran to the showers, turning the faucet on until a jet of water spewed forth. The protective membrane of my suit was quickly turning to goo, but the water seemed to halt the damage. I stood under the shower for what seemed like an eternity. All around me, the anguished cries of the anomaly could be heard as the acid did its job. I thought about Janice and the kids waiting for me back home. I thought about Jason with his metal D&D miniatures at my dinner table. Tears ran down my face as I prayed for the horror to be over. When the sprinklers did stop, I cautiously exited the locker room, navigating through the nightmarish corridors of the facility with flashlight in hand. Piles of steaming bodies littered the passageways, a sight that made me dry heave into the respirator. After several minutes, I found the main lobby where the elevator was. In front of me stood a young, naked boy, shivering in the beam of my flashlight. The boy was only 5 or 6 years of age, his face red from crying.
"Please, no more hurt,"
the boy cried as he wiped snot from his nose. There was an innocence about the child, but I knew he didn't belong. When I stepped towards him, he retreated with a face of genuine fear.
"You're the original?" I asked.
The boy looked down to the floor before replying.
I'm what's left. I just wanted to be."
"You killed the others!" I yelled, balling my fists together, hot rage welling up inside. The boy jumped at the sound of my voice and began shaking.
They kept trying to hurt us! Hurt me!"
I stopped my advance, the anger slowly receding. It was true. The anomaly had tried several times to coexist, and each time it was torched, poisoned, shot, and finally dissolved. Could it be that the anomaly was its own life force, not just a twisted image of us? I took off my glove and reached my open hand out towards the child. The boy cautiously took it. We rode the elevator up and walked out into the sun shining through the windows of the lobby. The guard met us with his weapon drawn, but lowered it with a look of confusion. "Behave yourself," I said, looking down to the boy. The boy looked up to me and then waved at the guard.
"Bring your son to work day, remember?" I said.
The guard, still baffled, nodded and stepped to the side, allowing us to exit. When we arrived home, Janice met us on the front porch. Toby, my son, and Sarah, my daughter, washed me off with the garden hose before I took the chemical suit off. Janice brought fresh clothes from the house, handing me a towel to dry off and an oversized shirt for the boy. They were curious about the boy, seeming to accept his presence more the longer he was there. I sat on the porch step, my wife joining me. Toby and Sarah whispered something and giggled, causing the boy to smile. Then the three were off, chasing each other through the manicured front yard as the sun dipped past the trees of our neighborhood. I didn't know what would come next. Would the army come knocking? What would I do about Jason? Had I made a mistake bringing the anomaly home after seeing what it could do? My wife leaned her head on my shoulder, taking my hand into hers. The boy was now chasing Toby around a crepe myrtle, while Sarah jumped up and down, laughing. The anomaly was becoming what it always wanted to be. Accepted. You've just heard Familiar Acceptance by Shane H. Sellers. Shane Sellers is not just an avid writer, he's a maestro of the macabre, specializing in tales of the wicked and sinister that stalk in the shadows of the mind. As the imaginative force behind the Carrying Creature feature YouTube channel, Shane breathes life into his dark tales, leaving audiences stunned with every blood-soaked word. Well, well, nothing like closing out with a good old shapeshifter story. In fact, listeners, you might want to scroll back through your podcast history to hear some older episodes of Horror Hill, just to make sure that I'm not an otherworldly monster that has implanted itself into your memories. Regardless of my own dubious existence, I'd like to thank you for listening tonight. As I record these stories, alone, in my studio, with only the occasional rustling in the corridor outside and the sound of distant screams to keep me company, it warms my heart to think of all of you joining in. Of course, the stories themselves are the stars of this show, so extra thanks go to John Westrick and Shane H. Sellers for tonight's tales. As always, I'll be back next week, so be sure to tune in at the same day and time. Until then, my friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek.
Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.